So our passage this evening, as we work through Daniel, is Daniel chapter 3. And amidst then all the excitement in chapter 2 of King Nebuchadnezzar having that dream and Daniel telling the dream and interpreting the dream and Nebuchadnezzar consequently promoting Daniel, amidst all the excitement of that, there's a little detail that we can easily miss, and it's in chapter 2 verse 49, and it's this: Daniel made a request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But that appointment then of those three men to that role, however incidental it may have appeared there at the end of chapter 2, now in chapter 3 it proves to be hugely significant. It's because of that appointment that Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego become caught up here in one of the Bible's most iconic stories. Now, because this story is so iconic, I don't need to take you through it this evening in any kind of detailed way, through its every twist and turn. Most of you will be quite familiar with all of that. And so instead we can devote our time this evening to the significance of this narrative. Assuming that this narrative isn't simply a lifeline for Sunday school teachers, assuming that it's more than that, then what is it? What is its significance? Apart from being a jolly good story, what do we have here in Daniel chapter 3? Well, I want to suggest we have three things. First of all, an exposure. An exposure. And I mean then an exposure of false religion. An exposure of false religion. So verses 1 to 3 describe this project of Nebuchadnezzar's, the erecting of a colossal image, and then the organizing of a big dedication ceremony for that image. And while as readers then we're kind of suspicious about this whole affair from the outset, there is at least the possibility, I suppose, that it might just be a harmless art project, you know, akin to the Angel of the North there in Gateshead, or those huge metal horses some of you may have seen near Falkirk, the Kelpies, as they're called. That there's that slim possibility, at least. Until that is, we come to verse 4, and in verses 4 to 7, it becomes very clear this is no mere art project. This image is an object of worship. This occasion on the plain of Jura, attended by all these bigwigs from across the empire, it's a religious occasion. They are gathering together for religious activity. Now, of course, it's this worship service that will land Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in so much trouble. And we could conclude then that that is its sole significance within Daniel chapter 3. The main event in this chapter is these three men being consigned to the fiery furnace. The worship service serves simply as an explanation of how that came about. And that's it. The narrator in verses 1 to 7 is doing nothing more than building up to the main event that he wants to tell us about. We could conclude that. But I think it's unlikely that that's all that the narrator is doing. I mean, the Bible, and especially the Old Testament, rarely passes on an opportunity to expose false religion for what it is. It's a recurring theme, isn't it? Whether you're reading Moses, or you're reading Isaiah, or you're reading the Psalmist, it's just a recurring theme, this exposure of false religion for what it really is. And it's likely then that that is present here also. In which case, we must ask the question, which aspects of false religion are being exposed in Daniel chapter 3? Well, let me just mention a couple. First of all, it's lifelessness. It's lifelessness. Because that seems to me a theme of verses 1 to 7. There's the lifelessness, the obvious lifelessness of the thing being worshipped here. This image. And the narrator's repetition of that phrase, set up. The image was that which Nebuchadnezzar set up. It's there in verse 1, it's there in verse 2, it's there in verse 3, it's there in verse 5, it's there in verse 7. He just keeps using that phrase, the image which he set up. If you're a parent this Christmas buying a Playmobil toy for your child, then you'll have to set it up. If, on the other hand, you're a parent buying a dog or a hamster for your child, you won't have to set it up. Why? Because it's a living thing. It's lifeless things that need to be set up. And this image, then, it's a lifeless thing. And so it needs to be set up. And then, interestingly, that lifelessness kind of spills over into the worshippers too. I mean, this service here, it's so regimented, isn't it? These worshippers are like robots bowing down when they hear the appropriate signal. Indeed, surely the writer is poking fun at the whole thing. All these instruments, by the way, if you're from north of the border, don't get too excited about the bagpipes there. There's some dispute over the translation of that, as with some of the other instruments as well. But surely the narrator, with this list of instruments, he's suggesting that these worshippers are almost as unresponsive as the image itself. And it needs this blaring cacophony of noise from all these incompatible instruments to stir them into some kind of life. It's exactly what we sang in our opening praise tonight from Psalm 115. Listen to what the psalmist says there. Talking about the nations of the world, he says, their idols are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths but do not speak, eyes but do not see. They have ears but do not hear, noses but do not smell. They have hands but do not feel, feet but do not walk, and they do not make a sound in their throats. And then this, those who make them become like them, and so do all who trust in them. Fascinating thought, isn't it? These worshippers becoming like the thing they worship, becoming as lifeless as the thing they worship. And I think that's what the narrator is getting at here. These worshippers are as unresponsive and lifeless as the golden image before which they're bowing. And by the way, that interesting idea, I think it probably applies beyond just statue worship. That idea of worshippers becoming like their God. Think of a very modern phenomenon, pornography. Is that a God? Well, Paul writes, doesn't he, in Philippians 3:19, of those whose God is their belly. And the commentators will all tell you that belly there probably isn't just referring to food, but all the sensual appetites. It's representative of them all. And that probably means then that we can class pornography as a modern God. And we hear, don't we, an increasing number of reports about the far-reaching effects of pornography in terms of the way that men relate to women in the real world. Idolizing these twisted, perverted relationships on screen, their own relationships become twisted and perverted and dysfunctional. It's again the same principle from Psalm 115 and Daniel 3. Worshippers becoming like the false god that they worship. So that's one thing being exposed about false religion, its lifelessness. And then secondly, its corruption. It's corruption. You can't miss the connection, can you, in the very opening verse of Daniel 3 with the previous chapter. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image. Well, of course, there was an image, same word in the Aramaic, there was an image at the heart of chapter 2. And it can't then merely be coincidence. And I think probably what we're seeing here is Nebuchadnezzar, in the erection of this image in chapter 3, to some extent reacting to the dream that he'd had some time earlier recorded in chapter 2, and reacting then in perhaps a couple of ways. So for one thing, remember that in the dream, gold represented the Babylonian Empire. And remember then that only the head of the image was gold, because the Babylonian Empire was going to be succeeded by other empires. And so it was just the head was gold, because that was the only bit of the entire thing that was Babylon. And then Babylon would pass, and another empire would come. And perhaps then, after a while, reflecting on that dream, Nebuchadnezzar had bristled at this idea that the Babylonian Empire was just going to be one chapter and was then going to pass away. And perhaps then it's him defying the dream and defying the God who had sent this dream, as he here makes this image in which it's not just the head that's gold, but the whole thing is gold. As if to say, Babylon, represented by gold, it's not just going to be a passing thing. My empire is going to be a lasting empire. And then perhaps in another way, he's reacting to the dream. Do you remember how there was a reference in the dream in verse 41 of chapter 2 to a divided kingdom? A divided kingdom. And perhaps then that has stuck in Nebuchadnezzar's mind. And he's thinking then, well, if division and disunity so threatens kingdoms, then I am going to do all in my power to keep my kingdom united. And what better way of keeping a kingdom united is there than by ensuring it has a shared religious experience? And so I'm going to erect this huge image, and I'm going to call people from all across the empire to this place to all worship together, because that will solidify the empire and that will bring us together as an empire, and that will ensure that we're not a divided kingdom. Now, of course, Nebuchadnezzar, if he did think like that, was missing the point, because there in that dream, it wasn't really division that was going to bring the statue crashing down. It was the stone, which we said last time represents God's kingdom, God's king, Jesus. That's what was going to bring the statue in chapter 2 crashing down. But nonetheless, that may well be how Nebuchadnezzar is thinking. And so in constructing this image then, I'm saying he's reacting quite possibly to the dream that he'd had sometime previously. And if that interpretation is correct, it means that this project here in chapter 3, it isn't really about Babylonian gods being honored at all. That's how it's been advertised, that's how it's been publicized, and so when those men come to him accusing Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they say at the end of verse 12 that these three men, they do not serve your gods. So it's been advertised as a God-worshipping exercise, but that's really just a facade. Really, this is about Nebuchadnezzar. And he's doing this to solidify and to consolidate his own kingdom. He's doing it for his own sake. He's doing it to establish himself and his empire. It's all really about him. And so that's what I mean then by the corruption here. In the name of religion, in the name of worshipping the gods, Nebuchadnezzar is really just looking after himself. And of course, religion throughout the ages has been one of the worst culprits, hasn't it, in all the world, when it comes to exploiting people. Because religious worshippers are so vulnerable to exploitation, because they so sincerely and desperately want to please their God or their gods. And of course, Christianity, sadly, tragically, has seen its fair share of exploitation and corruption infiltrated. And again, the gods of our contemporary society, are they not often exploitative? Think of wealth, possessions. That's definitely, in New Testament terms, a god. and a God that's very alive and well then in our society today. And this Christmas then, enormous multinational businesses will take advantage of millions of people who are in the grip of that God, the God of possessions, and they will put out adverts indicating that these presents are just what your loved ones need and are just what will make your loved ones happy. When really, of course, it's just what will make these businesses and all their shareholders very rich. And that's what lies behind it all. And again, then, it's these contemporary religions of our society corrupt and being used as channels of exploitation. And so false religion then is being exposed in Daniel chapter 3, and the exposure has relevance, I think, down the ages and even into our own day in our own situation, an exposure. But then secondly, notice with me, we have here in our chapter an encouragement. An encouragement. So you know what happens. You know how Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego refuse to comply with this worship service. And because of that, then they are consigned to this fiery furnace. And having been cast into the furnace, they then remarkably survive. What's the application then that as readers we should take home from this aspect of the story? Tomorrow morning, if at work you get thrown into a fiery furnace, you'll be okay. Is that the application we should take home? Well, thankfully it's fairly unlikely that that will happen to you at work tomorrow morning. And actually for the exiles, generally, those Israelite exiles for whom probably this book of Daniel was originally designed and prepared, those exiles in Babylon, for them too, it was fairly unlikely that they would get cast into a fiery furnace in the way that these three men did. I mean, it's a very singular set of circumstances that ends up with them being thrown into the furnace. And it was unlikely then to be something that most of those exiles for whom this book was written and for whom it was prepared were going to encounter. So what is the purpose of the story then? Well, we need to realize that those first readers, those exiles in Babylon, they would have recognized a powerful symbolism to the story. Now, I don't mean for a moment that the story itself is merely symbolic and didn't actually happen. Of course, it did happen. We're dealing with real history here. But in the Bible, real events often have a powerful symbolic significance. Some of Jesus' miracles are like that, aren't they? They really happen, but they also had a powerful symbolic significance. And I think then that those exiles, they would have seen this furnace into which these men are thrown, they would have seen this furnace as symbolic of their exile situation. A key text in this regard is Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 20. And this then is the Lord speaking to the children of Israel just before they cross over into the promised land, speaking through Moses. And this is what Moses says then in Deuteronomy 4:20, "The Lord has taken you," that is you Israelites, "and brought you out of the iron furnace, out of Egypt, to be a people of his own inheritance, as you are this day." So you see there how the Egyptian bondage, the Egyptian slavery, which the Israelites endured for all those centuries, it is described as a furnace. And then another key text in this regard is Isaiah chapter 48 and verse 10. And in Isaiah 48 then, verse 10, this is Isaiah who prophesies the Babylonian exile and then looks beyond the exile. That's what he's doing here. And he has then Yahweh kind of speaking to his people after the exile and saying, behold, I have refined you, but not as silver. I have tried you in the furnace of affliction. Again, same word, furnace, which there then isn't now describing Egyptian bondage, but Babylonian bondage, Babylonian exile. And so it would have been then natural when there were these texts in the Old Testament which used a furnace as a symbol of an exile situation for God's people, and even this very exile situation that they were now in, Isaiah had likened that to a furnace, Babylonian exile. It would have been very natural for those exiles to see in this literal furnace here in our passage a symbol of that exile. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's survival then within the furnace would have spoken to them that they were going to survive as a people. Israel was going to survive. God's chosen people was going to survive in the furnace that was Babylon, just as these three men had survived in that very literal furnace on the plains of Jura. Indeed, we can perhaps go further. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego survive in this furnace through the presence with them in it of a heavenly visitor. Now, within the passage itself, it's not made clear whether that visitor is angelic or divine, but clearly their survival is through the presence with them in the furnace of a heavenly visitor. Now think back to one of the most famous incidents in the Old Testament. I'm thinking of Exodus chapter 3, and Moses is there shepherding out in the wilderness, and he encounters that very strange phenomenon, a bush that's on fire, but the bush isn't being burnt up, and a voice speaks to him from the bush. What does it all mean? Well, there are different interpretations of what it all means, but I think it's highly possible and likely that it means this, that the bush is representative of God's people. And the fire then is again that Egyptian bondage situation that God's people were then in, the furnace that they were presently existing in there in Egypt. And the bush not being consumed then was indicative that God's people was not going to be consumed there in Egypt. And there, of course, in that case, you have the additional dimension of God being in it all. The voice speaks out of the bush. God is there in it. And it's because of God's presence then that the bush is not consumed, that God's people in Egypt are not going to be consumed. In other words, the picture we have now in Daniel 3, as I say, it's not just a picture, it's a real event, but it's also a picture. The picture we have now in Daniel 3, it's in many ways just a repeat of the picture that Moses encountered there in the wilderness that day. It's another picture of God's people not being consumed within the furnace. The furnace in Moses' day was Egypt. The furnace at this point is Babylon. But it's the same message that's coming across. God's people not being consumed, and not being consumed because God is present with them. And now perhaps then the relevance of this becomes a little clearer for ourselves. No, hopefully you won't be thrown into a furnace tomorrow. But tomorrow, and the day after, and the day after that, you will belong to a people. to the people of the living God, the Church of Jesus Christ, that in this world generally is opposed and hated, indeed ever increasingly so within our own society. A people, in other words, that exists within a fiery furnace. And it doesn't matter whether the furnace is Egyptian in its nature, or Babylonian in its nature, or something else in its nature. Always, until Christ returns, God's people, they exist in a fiery furnace. That's where we are at in this world that hates God and therefore hates his people. And Exodus 3 and Daniel 3 then are encouraging us with this message. God's people will not be consumed. Yes, God's people must live until Christ returns within a fiery furnace. That's what this world is. But God's people will survive. God's church will not be burnt up within that furnace. Not because God's people can match the world in terms of resources or in terms of tactics or anything like that, but because God is there with his people. I love the fact that this heavenly visitor here in our passage, who then, by analogy with Exodus 3, I think probably is divine rather than angelic. I love the way that he's said by Nebuchadnezzar to be walking around. They're all walking around. So he's walking there in that furnace. Makes me think of Revelation chapter 2 and verse 1, where we read this. The words of him who holds the seven stars in his right hand. It's talking about Jesus Christ, who walks among the seven golden lampstands. Another heavenly figure walking. It's Christ. And the seven golden lampstands, we've been told in the previous verse, are those seven local churches to which the letter of Revelation is being addressed. And it's this picture of Christ walking amongst those churches, present within them. And they're small churches like ours, and they're problem-filled churches. They're just ordinary congregations in that first century world. And John sees Christ walking amongst them. Didn't mean that those churches, by the way, were indestructible, because there was a very real danger that at least one of them was going to be destroyed by Christ himself, removing the lampstand. But that's the only way that Christ's churches can be destroyed. And that's the only kind of destruction that we need to worry about. We don't need to worry about the world destroying us, about the flames destroying us. The only thing we need to worry about is Christ himself removing the lampstand, because we've ceased to be faithful to him and to his word. And so this encouragement then, God's people will survive in the fiery furnace of this world until Christ comes. An exposure, an encouragement. And then thirdly and finally, we have in our passage an example. An example. Because surely then Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego are wonderful examples for us, aren't they here? In their faithfulness to God. Their willingness to lay down their lives rather than lie down on the plain of Jura before that golden image. Now, at this point, I think I must touch on an awkwardness that we have within our text. And it's verses 17 and 18. So verse 17 reads in the ESV, and I think probably most of the English versions are fairly similar. If this be so, in other words, if you're going to throw us into the furnace, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods, etc. So the way it's translated there, these men are assuming God's ability to save them from the furnace, but they can't presume upon God's willingness to do that, that God will in fact do that in this situation. They can't read his secret plans. I think that's a convenient translation, which conveniently overlooks what the text actually says. The text really reads something like this: if our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, ... In other words, when they say, but if not, they're not actually doubting God's willingness. They're doubting, or they're questioning God's ability. They're saying, if he's able, he will. But if not, we're still going to anyway. Which may sound like a very disappointing way of reading the text. And what are we to do with this then? Are we to write off these men whom for centuries have been lauded as heroes? Well, no, I don't think we should write them off at all. I think rather we should simply conclude that their behavior here, their actual behavior, exceeded their verbal profession. Because they were willing to lay down their lives. Their actual behavior went beyond, it exceeded their verbal profession. It's far more common, of course, the other way around, isn't it? That our verbal profession exceeds our actual behavior. And we say, oh yes, our God is mighty and he can do anything. And we sing hymns about that here on a Sunday. And then Monday morning comes and we're in work and someone says something derogatory about our Savior and we should speak up, and we don't. And so our verbal professions go beyond our actual behavior. Our behavior lags behind. It's the other way around with these men. It's their verbal profession that lags behind. Their behavior is amazing. And they are willing to go into the furnace for this God. And so I don't think we should really be hard on these three men. We should admire them. And by the way, think of how easily they could have rationalized just bowing down outwardly to that image. We're not really engaging in worship in our hearts. And after all, there's so much at stake here. We, as I said in my prayer this evening, you know, we men, we've been appointed to this role where we can exercise such an influence. It would be suicidal to throw that away for our principles now. All we have to do is bow down with everyone else, and then we can be men of influence in this pagan land. And they're young men, and they're gifted men. And it would have been so easy for them to rationalize, just complying with the decree. And yet they won't comply with the royal decree. And as we close, I just want to ask, how do they go through with this? In the face of this threat of the furnace, how are these men able to defy the king? How are these men able to opt for the furnace rather than bow before the image? Well, just two reasons. First of all, because of the limitations of the fire. Because of the limitations of the fire. Now, that might sound a ridiculous thing to say. This fire was so formidable. Probably formidable to start with, and then of course it's made more formidable than usual, so much so that these flames are shooting out of the chimney at the top and burn these men who are about to throw Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego into it. But I think the narrator gives us a very telling little phrase in this passage. He puts it on the lips of King Nebuchadnezzar. It's at the end when Nebuchadnezzar is in amazement. He's brought the men out of the furnace because they've survived. And this is what he says in verse 28. Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trust in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. They yielded up their bodies. And that's what I mean then when I refer to the limitations of the fire. It was a terrible fire. It was a hot fire. But it was a fire which could only touch their bodies. It could only destroy their bodies. It couldn't destroy any more than that. Now you might say, well, Dan, you're making an awful lot of that little reference to the bodies there in verse 28. But doesn't it kind of bring to mind a matrix of New Testament texts, some of which I think probably have Daniel 3 in mind? You think of Jesus' well-known words in several of the Gospels, Luke chapter 12, verse 4, I tell you, my friends, do not fear those who kill the body, and after that have nothing more that they can do. But I will warn you whom to fear. Fear him who, after he is killed, has authority to cast into hell. Don't fear those who can destroy the body. Don't fear fire that can merely destroy the body and nothing more. And then that takes you on to something else Jesus said. Mark chapter 13, verse 42. And here he uses the exact words from the Greek version of Daniel 3. I think probably he is alluding to Daniel 3. It's Matthew 13, 42. It's one of his parables. And he says this, that the Son of Man, verse 41, will send his angels. They will gather out of his kingdom all causes of sin and all lawbreakers, verse 42, and throw them into the fiery furnace. Same phrase, fiery furnace in the Greek as in Daniel 3. But they're, of course, not talking about some kiln that bricks were made in, but talking about hell. And that then leads to Hebrews 11. And in Hebrews 11, I think Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are alluded to. Remember how Hebrews 11 is about those Old Testament figures of faith. And we have that list at the end. And what more shall I say, the writer says, verse 32. Time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire. Probably a reference to Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. Quench the power of fire. And that's an interesting verb in the Greek, quenched. Because that's been used by Jesus in Mark 9:48, in this way, he talks about those being thrown into hell where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego faced a fire that could be quenched. There will be many, Jesus says, who will face a fire that cannot be quenched. And I'm saying then that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego could go through with this. And they could opt for the fire because they knew the fire was limited, actually. It wasn't the fire into which millions will one day be cast. I think one of our problems as believers is that we have far too low a view of hell. And because we have a low view of the thing we have been saved from, hell, we have often far too high a view of all the things we haven't been saved from. Illness and accident and financial trouble and all the problems that we face in this life. And they become so big, and we sometimes say, well, why isn't God doing anything about these? If God were real, if God really loved me, he would do something about this problem. Well, if we had a proper estimation of the problem that God has saved us from, the fire that he has delivered us from, I'm sure we would never, ever speak in that way. We need to understand that Jesus has taken our eternal fire on the cross of Calvary. And therefore, whatever fire we face in this life, whatever trials we face in this life, they are tiddly by comparison. Tiddly by comparison to what we should be facing, but aren't solely because of Christ. So they can go through with this because of the limitations of the fire, and then they can go through with it because of the limitations of the present. I mean, of the present age. I mean, here they are, these young men, and they have this prestigious future lying ahead of them, being important men in Babylon, exercising such influence. How can they throw that away and be thrown into this fire? Well, it's Hebrews 11 again, isn't it? Why are all the people mentioned in Hebrews 11 mentioned in Hebrews 11? Because they had faith. What's the faith being talked about in Hebrews 11? Faith in the world to come, the city without foundation, the city with foundations, the better country, the heavenly country. That's the faith of Hebrews 11. That's the faith then that these three men must have had. Otherwise, they would never be mentioned there. They had faith in a better world, in a future to come. And that's why they were willing to throw away their present, because they had a future. You see, if the present is all you've got, then you'll cling to it like anything, won't you? Why is it that people make Christmas such an enormous thing and put up the decorations in the middle of September and go into debt, and it's this huge, huge thing? Well, because it's all they've got. Why is it that people are driven almost to suicide by the fluctuating fortunes of Newcastle United? Because it's all they've got. Why is it that politicians will get so rude with each other, and the debate about Brexit becomes so toxic on our television programs? Because it's all they've got. And for these men, Babylon wasn't all they had. Being rulers of the province of Babylon wasn't all they had. They had a heavenly country for which they were heading. And they could give up the present at the drop of a hat. May we be those who live for the future, not for the little bits of tinsel that the present is. May we live for the heavenly country like these men did. Amen.